Hey folks, and welcome to another episode of Podcraft. This is the show about everything podcasting, from equipment to interview skills and everything in between. I'm Colin Gray, your usual host, and this time around we've got an interview with another experienced podcaster, but also very experienced in an area I've been wanting to cover for quite a while now. Now, one of the biggest questions we often get are around the, you know, the legalities of podcasting, of creating content, about put it out there. And I've been trying to chase down somebody who knows something about this, somebody with some expertise, and I happen to come across a fine chap named Gordon Firemark. How are you doing, Gordon?
I'm very good. Thank you, Colin. I don't think I've ever been described as a fine chap before.
Well, I'm glad to be the first. So, Gordon, you're an entertainment lawyer, is that right? Do you mind telling me, what exactly does the day-to-day of an entertainment lawyer look like?
Well, my world is, first of all, there are two kinds of lawyers. Here in the States, we don't make the distinction between solicitors and barristers the way some people in the Commonwealth nations do. But so there are litigators and the courtroom lawyers, and then those of us that do the transactional, we're all called attorneys or lawyers, and so that's that. I am on the transactional side. So I negotiate contracts, I make deals, I help clients with starting up their companies and registering their trademarks and protecting their intellectual property like copyrights, and all of the deals, contracts, and negotiations that go on in those areas, and advising them, you know, on how to stay out of trouble so they don't wind up in the courtroom.
Excellent. Good stuff. Yeah, well, so I've been wanting to talk to somebody like yourself for a while because there's quite a few little questions that come up often in podcasting and general content creation, actually, around how you put your stuff out there. And I think the first thing I wanted to ask was around how you do this internationally. So obviously I'm in the UK, you're in the US, and we've got lots of people listening around the world. So this is, I suppose, every question during this, our chat here, will be in the context of people who could live anywhere, actually, but they are broadcasting internationally. So a bigger proportion of our audience is US-based than UK-based, even though we're a UK-based company. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what are the sort of first things you think you have to think about in terms of putting your content out there, and thinking about, is there any sort of first steps you think when it's to keep on the right side of the law when it comes to international broadcasting?
Well, most of the principles that we'll talk about are universal or near universal. You know, the first one that comes to mind is copyright, and really I sort of categorize all of this under, you know, three or four categories. The first is, you know, treat it like a business. Even if you're a hobbyist podcaster, what you're doing is making media and distributing it. And that is going to look to the outside world as though it's a business, whether you're monetizing or not. And so be businesslike about things. Use contracts and be mindful of your property and of property of others. So the property of others part is the first major point of concern, I would say. And that is when you use someone else's literary or musical or cinematic material, whatever, you are probably infringing on someone else's copyright. Copyright law, fairly universally, we have an international treaty that 186 countries, I believe it is, are signed to this Berne Convention on copyright law. And so most of the principles are very much the same. When you create a work of original authorship, you own a copyright in that, and that copyright gives the owner the exclusive right to make copies, to distribute those copies, to perform the work in public or display it if it's that kind of work, and to make derivative works, that is to elaborate and adapt and turn it into something else. Those are the basic principles that the owner of the copyright has the right to do that and to allow others. So if you're incorporating somebody else's stuff, you're stepping on one of those rights if you don't have permission. Now, there are some exceptions and things, but that's the general rule. And vice versa, when you create work, you own it and you're entitled to those same protections.
Great. So with written work, you often see the copyright notice at the bottom of a webpage, say. That's a question I've always had. Is that necessary, or do you own the copyright as standard? And how does that apply to audio work?
So the notice of copyright is not a requirement, at least under U.S. law and most of the other countries, I believe. You're not required to put a notice on it. You're not required to make a registration. Here in the U.S., registration is required before a lawsuit can be commenced, but you can do that the day before you file the suit. There are some advantages to registering early, but the presence or absence of a copyright notice really only goes to whether somebody might be considered an innocent infringer, and that can mitigate some of the damage, the amount of money that would be on the hook for in that situation. Yeah. But basically, the copyright exists from the moment of inception without...
Right. So presumably podcast material, there's no need to say it. It's just it's owned by you. You can prove it's yours by being your voice, I guess. Is that how it works?
Pretty much. And obviously if you've got transaction records of when you uploaded the file to the hosting company, those kinds of things will be evidence in the case proving that you own something. If you're, copying from a major film, then people will know. If you're copying from a written work, then presumably it was published somewhere. That's how you got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those kind of things.
Perfect. So there's two things related to that I want to delve into then. You've got two uses of material, I think, that you often hear in podcasts and people want to do. One of which is music, and one of which is, stuff like film clips or from other people's podcasts. So the first one there, I think, that would be good to delve into is the music side of things, because a lot of people want to have theme music in their shows. You get libraries out there which are copyright free and supposedly royalty free, supposedly free entirely cost wise to use. You get other libraries that you can buy the royalties or the rights to use a bit of music. Now, I've often been a little bit confused about the terminology around this. So what are we looking for in the first place for the terminology to say that means that we can use a bit of music for free cost wise, or if we're buying it to make sure we're getting the right to use that in our show forever?
Yeah. So, I don't think any of the music that we're talking about, there is music that is copyright free, that is very old musical composition, no longer protected under copyright law, the public domain. But anything else is going to have a copyright. Mm. It's a question of whether the owner has granted you or the public generally the right to use it. So royalty free music libraries basically are in the business of selling for a one-time fee. This is general principles. You buy it once and you can use it over and over again. Mm-hmm. There are scenarios also where you buy it once and for each use you have to pay a royalty, and that's just a standard, royalty deal. So you do need to be careful when licensing music to understand what you're buying. If the library calls itself royalty free, you should be able to rely on that, but double check to make sure that that they are in fact granting the rights. For example, if you're using it as your show intro, that may be different from the kind of use they normally expect. It's just going to be a bed under one little scene in a movie or something like that. So make sure it's appropriate for what you're doing. There are free music sources, usually under what we call the Creative Commons licensing scenario, which basically is the owners are saying, as long as you give me attribution and aren't using it for commercial purposes, you can use this music. Just don't change it. There are variations on that. And that's creativecommons.org is the organization that sort of manages the creation of those licenses. But basically by putting that notice on a work, that the owner is saying, go ahead and use this. Here are the conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Usually.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right there. I got my terminology wrong, didn't I? It's not copyright free. It's royalty free we're looking for. You buy a royalty free you license a royalty-free track. I'll try and use the right terminology. Mm-hmm. You license a royalty-free track, but you're saying as well that there are often different types of licenses. One that might say you can only use it as a bed under one section, one that might say you can use it unlimited. What are there kind of common types of licenses out there?
Well, when I say there's different types of licenses, what I'm really saying is that each royalty-free music library is going to have slight variations in the conditions on their licenses. So, they may have a very low price license for the one-time kind of use and a different price for the repeated use, if you're using it as a show open or something like that.
Sure.
But just make sure you're buying what you think you're buying, and that ought to be explicitly stated.
Yeah. So this is a case of, it's not like the terms and conditions you just scroll right through, don't even look at when you're signing up for services and tick. This is a case where we actually should be reading the terms really here.
And most of the libraries actually have a, you know, an explanation of the different, if they have multiple classes of licenses, they'll explain what does the basic license, what does the platinum license include, and so on.
Yeah.
And just, you know, just do your homework. Don't dive in blindly. So yeah, right. Don't just scroll past and say, yes, I read it.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. So what about, that's kind of the royalty-free music libraries. They're selling stuff for low cost, maybe $10, $30, $50, and you get a license for that track. But commercial music is obviously a different proposition entirely. Is it possible? Is it feasible? Is it, cost effective to use commercial licensing for podcasters? How would we go about that?
Well, you know, it can be, but there are scenarios where it can be very, very expensive. If you want to use a Beatles or a Rolling Stones song, you're going to pay a heavy price for doing so. But there are bits of music out there that are, you know, much more affordable and accessible, and sometimes the owners are willing to let it go for a low price. I know there's a very prolific podcaster by the name of Dan Miller who uses, I've forgotten what song it is now, but he, you know, decided that he wanted to use this song, and he reached out to the record label and the music publisher. And that's something we'll talk about, is there's two copyrights to think about. But he reached out and he offered them, I don't know, he asked them for a license and suggested $100 a year for, and it's his show opening song. Sure. It's a taking care of business. That's the song. And, they've allowed him to do it, I think, for $100 a year.
Oh,
and
excellent.
You know, so you know, don't be afraid to ask. The worst they can say is no. And you might be surprised at how affordable things are.
Is that the normal route in then, actually contacting the artist directly, or how would you normally start that process?
Well, the artists don't generally retain ownership of the work quite in the way that suggests. So, you know, generally speaking, let's talk about the two copyrights first and then I'll explain. So when a songwriter sits down and writes a song, he or she has created a work of authorship. So there's a copyright in the composition. Compositions are generally managed or administered by a music publishing company, which has basically bought the song from the songwriter in exchange for paying them some percentage of the revenues that are generated from the song. Seems very straightforward.
Sure,
it's actually a tremendously complex business. But then when that song is recorded by a recording artist, there's a second creative work that's been created, the recording. And that is owned usually by the record company that paid for the recording to happen and is distributing the record. So when you use a recorded piece of music, you have to get permission for both the composition and the recording, which are both being incorporated in your episode or your whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, you only need that if you're using a recorded composition. If you decide that you're going to hire a band or a musician to play that piece of music and make your own recording, then obviously you only need the composition rights.
So even if you were to play it yourself, grab a guitar and play a song yourself, even if it was just a riff from the song, that counts as something you should be getting clearance from the artist for then?
Well, now you mentioned just a riff, and that's one of the little important exceptions that exists, at least in the United States. And I believe the UK has a similar principle. But so let's talk about this. It's called fair use in the US and fair dealing in some other countries, Canada, I believe, UK. So in the US, this concept of fair use arose because we have copyright law, which is a restriction on the kinds of things you can do. Speech, right? Free speech is covered by our First Amendment. So there's an inherent conflict. Mm-hmm. You have free speech, except this isn't free. So the courts had to come up with a system to address that conflict. And they developed this doctrine called fair use that takes a look at four factors of the use in question and decides, does it come down more on the free speech side or more on the let's protect the owner side? And that's a determination that's made on an individual case by case basis. Now, my understanding is that the doctrines of fair dealing are very similar, but you don't have a First Amendment in quite the same way. You do have free speech, but you don't have the same degree of constitutional guarantee as we do. So that's an area where you have to check a little bit if you're based in the country. A
different country, yeah.
The US, just check the local,
So to take the US as an example then, is there, and I've heard there's a bit of a gray area here, but is there a criteria around fair use? Like you can use 10% of a song, 20% of a song?
So there is no rule of thumb. And the reason behind that is that it's possible to take the substance of a song by only taking a couple of measures, to use a Beethoven example. When you hear bum, 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 you know which piece. That's four notes.
Four.
We've taken the meat of the piece without taking very much quantity-wise. So there's the amount and substantiality of the portion taken is one of the four factors that we have to consider.
Yeah.
The nature of the original, the market impact, and the nature of the use in question, the purpose and character of the use. So, if we're using it for educational or for commentary and criticism, that's much more likely to favor fair use than, we're using it as a commercial jingle or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
A show open is a little different than just a little piece of music used in the interstitial to transition from one segment to another.
Yes.
We end up looking at all four of these factors and the totality of the circumstances and how much has the work been transformed into a new artwork, basically. And, most podcast uses aren't going to cross over that transformative side. So a tiny little snippet, probably okay.
Yeah.
The more you've used, the less likely.
And the more regular as well. It seems like a criteria for it too. But from what you're saying, we can never be 100% sure. In these cases, is that right?
So, yes. So, fair use is it's a case by case analysis.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, by the time you get to really have the argument about whether something is a fair use, it's because you've used it and the owner has sued you, and you've now paid thousands and thousands of dollars to lawyers to defend you in court. A lot of owners will sort of acknowledge that it could be fair use if it's a very minor kind of a thing. They still have to do their due diligence and contact you and make sure understand what you used. It's a lot of hassle. I would recommend using royalty free or easily licensed material and don't rely on this fair use too much.
So applying that to TV and film as well, quite a lot of people want to include a little clip from a TV show, a film show. Is that basically the same principle? Is it okay to include like 30 seconds or a minute of a film?
It is the same principle. If you're discussing the film and criticizing or discussing the filmmakers and doing an analysis of something, I think that, on that purpose and character of the use factor, that weighs in favor of fair use. Again, if you're just doing it for comedy's sake or for fun, or do you remember that time when Han Solo said XYZ, that's probably not as much of fair use. And again, the amount and substantiality portion is important also. You can take sort of the most recognizable, meatiest chunk of a movie in just a sentence. Mm-hmm. And it could weigh in favor of the owner. So again, same analysis. You got to be, diligent about this. The good news is when you're taking a small clip of a movie, you're generally taking 30 seconds or less of something 2 hours long.
Yes.
Whereas with a song, you're taking 30 seconds of 3 minutes long.
Yeah, exactly. Percentage wise, much smaller. Yeah. Okay. No, that's interesting. Yeah. I've heard there's no solid answer to this, but that actually gives some really good criteria. At least you can judge it yourself around it. So that's really useful. Thanks.
With the understanding that you're taking some risk if you use something probably the worst case scenario is that you get a takedown notice and your episode has to go into the ash heap, which is no fun for anybody, but that'll be usually the first step, at least under the US law, the DMCA. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Actually on that, is that actually the worst case scenario, or could you be fined or anything like that for doing it?
Well, yes, of course, the owner could always sue for copyright infringement. Uh-huh. And here in the States, that could, mean anywhere from $750,000 to $150,000 in damages. But, the practical matter is that, the owner has to incur some fees and expenses in bringing that lawsuit and has to see that there are actually some damages to justify it. So typically getting it taken down is the objective.
Yeah.
That's the punishment. And we have a very easy mechanism for that.
And that's bad enough if you've spent hours creating a bit of content. And I mean, that's a pretty bad result anyway. So, yeah.
And some of the podcast hosts might adopt the three strikes policy that you, like YouTube does, where if you get caught three times, then they start to disable your account or refuse you access to things.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Just finish off on the music side of things. For if we were to try and get hold of some commercial music, license that, I believe I've heard in the past that there are sort of more central organizations that manage a lot of different copyrights. Is that the case, or am I mistaken there?
You know, here in the States, these kinds of license, there is no centralized agency for a license that would cover everything a podcaster needs. Sure. It's tricky because podcasting is, we both stream live, sometimes stream live, sometimes stream from a web-based player, but also it's a download to people's devices. Mm-hmm. So there's several different kinds of use going on. And so that's that. But I think what you're talking about are the organizations called performance rights organizations. Mm-hmm. Here in the US, those are ASCAP and BMI and CSAC. In Canada, it's SOCAN. In the UK, I think it's PRS is the name of
it. Yeah, that sounds right. Yep.
And in different countries, I believe there are some mechanism for these kinds of things. That's the other trick of this, is that because podcasting is a global medium, you theoretically have to have licenses that cover every territory that your listeners are in. So it's really tricky. And so going directly to the owners is most often the way to accomplish that, because they can always sort of bypass the societies.
Yes. Okay, no, that makes sense. That's great. Okay, I think that covers pretty much everything I need to know about music. I hope that gives listeners a good idea of how they could go about that, and a bit of a clearer view about the fair use question as well. So that's great. I think the other part that I wanted to go on to was around protecting our own work. So we've talked about the copyright aspect. So we have that copyright automatically. That's great. What about the other two aspects of it that I wanted to ask you about was, firstly, what about if we have somebody else involved in our material? So right now I'm interviewing yourself. This is something between the two of us. How does that work? Is that joint owned? And should I be thinking about giving people a contract? You mentioned contracts earlier. Should I be thinking about giving people contracts before I get them on my show?
I say to that, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I'm a bit of an evangelist on the subject. Use a release from... Well, use a release with every guest on your show. Now, you and I did not do a written release before we started the show. I'm happy to sign one if that's what you want, but I will say right now, I'm hereby granting you the permission to use this recording and this interview in perpetuity throughout the universe, in all media now known and hereafter devised.
Yes. So excellent. First time I've had that.
Generally, that is, a workable solution is to get them to acknowledge something like that on the show or in a recording. Mm-hmm. But I do advocate using a written release, and I have actually created a downloadable release that anybody can have for free. It's podcastrelease.com. Mm-hmm. And you can download this and, you know, use it, adapt it for your own purposes and so on. Perfect. It is a little bit challenging to get your guests to sign something in advance, especially, you know, it's a legal document and so on. So some people have adapted it and made it a web form that they, you know, click and type their name. And that generally is an acceptable approach also. Hmm. But it's definitely worthwhile because, here's a case in point. A client of mine last year was contacted by, she was on episode 100 and 200 of something of her show. A guest that was on episode 5 of the show saying, I don't like the direction your show has gone in. You're taking an opinion that's contrary to my beliefs. So I want that episode taken down and no references to me on your website. Hmm. And she hadn't gotten a signed release. So she was, you know, she resisted and she said, well, I'm going to explain why. And the woman didn't want any explanations, no reference to me whatsoever.
Yeah, sure.
So the lady ended up suing the show and they settled. But, you know, that was an expensive adventure that you can avoid it with one page document.
Yeah. So, well, that's great. Thank you for giving us the link to that. So I'll put that in the show notes if anybody wants to go and download that. Podcastrelease.com. I think it's something that came up within our membership, actually. One of our members was asking about it. We had a conversation back and forth. And I've used it for video in the past, funnily enough, running events. So videoing an event and stuff like that. You have participants and...
Photographers use model releases. Videographers use video, you know, so why shouldn't we recording our shows do the same?
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's just because it's kind of podcasting has grown up around the concept of interviews and people just haven't done it in the past, have they? So, but now that the medium's becoming more professional, more grown up, more, it's just, yeah, it maybe makes sense that we start to incorporate this a lot more.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. So last one was around trademarks, actually. So you talked earlier on about registering your trademarks, about your IP, that type of thing. Would you recommend, what stage does a podcaster have to get to before you would recommend actually investing in trademark protection?
You know, trademark protection, this is an area that does vary a bit from nation to nation. We do also have an international treaty on trademarks, but the process of registration is different from country to country and region to region. So that's something you want to check with locally a bit, but, basically if your show title is distinctive and becomes identified with you as a brand, then it's worth protecting. Now, a lot of shows like my own Entertainment Law Update, it's a very descriptive, title. And so descriptive here in the US anyway, I don't know what it is everywhere, but I believe it's the same. Descriptiveness is on the wrong side of the registrability line. Mm-hmm. It has to be distinctive enough to stand out. Now, over time, a very descriptive term can become distinctive by virtue of achieving a sort of secondary meaning in the mind of the public. So that's what you're going for if you're using a descriptive term. Now, if your show is Podcraft. It's a coined word, so it's more on the distinctive side, but it's also suggestive of what you're talking about, unless it's about building pods, I guess. So, you know, I have some question about whether it would go through easily. Probably would, and we would, you know, register it and defend on the basis that it's a coined phrase and therefore fairly distinctive. But or if it has nothing to do with what your show is about, you know, the heebie-jeebie show or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You probably could get a registration pretty easily. So
yeah.
Descriptiveness is the challenge. So once you've sort of attained, you know, I'd say 100 episodes is pretty good indication that you've achieved some distinctiveness, assuming you've got downloads to prove it too.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And what would you say the reasons would be behind somebody taking that step then? I mean, what's the thinking around the benefits of it?
Well, you don't want somebody else coming into the marketplace with a confusingly similar title for another show, whether it's in the same or a different medium. Let's say somebody wanted to make a television program called Podcraft, and it's teaching how to do podcasting by television. You would have a problem with that, I presume.
Indeed.
So that would be a valid reason to want to register a trademark to avoid, because you know, media is all going to fall probably under the same class of goods or services. Yeah, yeah. Somebody wants to create chewing gum called Podcraft, you're not going to be able to stop them.
Right. So it's by category as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the same, again, the marketplace and the consumer. Yeah.
And that would allow me to make a legal challenge similar to the takedown notice, I suppose, take down your business or your TV show or whatever it is that's named similarly and does. Yeah.
Yeah. There isn't such a streamlined mechanism in the trademark space, but usually a strong letter from a lawyer, what we call an astigram.
Yes.
will put them on notice and warn them that they better stop. And hopefully you catch it early enough that they haven't made a conspicuous investment in the thing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I believe there's a difference between registered trademark and a trademark. Is that right? Can you explain the difference?
Well, a registered trade here in the US, the little R in a circle symbol indicates that the trademark has been registered with the federal government and you have the sort of fullest protection under the law available. Trademark, similar to copyright, is something that you acquire the rights from using the mark. Once you've put it out there in commerce, you own, you have a right to prevent others in the same marketplace from competing with you unfairly. And both state and federal statute allow for, you know, provide for some protection there. But the registration is an a worthwhile added step to get you that full protection. And I believe similar in other countries that there is a sort of common law sense of what's permissible and I don't, again, you don't have to put a symbol on it, although putting a TN symbol on something is a good way of telling people, hey, I'm using this as my brand, so stay away.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like a lot of this is actually just, it's prevention, isn't it? As opposed to, just letting people know, like you say.
Okay. Locks on the doors of your home because you don't want people coming in and looking at your stuff or taking it. Yeah. Same thing with these.
Yes. Perfect. Okay. That's great. You mentioned at the start, so just to tie it up, you mentioned at the very start around contracts. Are there any other types of contracts that you recommend we have when we're in the world of podcasting or content creation? We've talked about the release, obviously. Is there anything else to think about?
Well, if you have co-hosts, where you're the same people on the show every episode, I think it's important to have some kind of a contract between the co-hosts and or the producer of the show to indicate who owns the show and what the various rights and responsibilities are, so that, you know, in the unfortunate event that someone isn't pulling their weight, they can be dismissed and the show goes on, or not, if you're the one who's not, you know, you're the owner.
Yes.
And also what happens if there's monetization, when revenue starts coming in, who gets what, who owns it, and those kinds of things. So I think the co-host agreement is very important. If you have sponsorships, then it's important to have that relationship in writing. So the expectations are laid out, as well as the timing of payments and those kinds of things, just in case things don't go so smoothly.
Indeed.
Beyond that, not much call for, again, there may be certain special situations where contracts are called for, but those are pretty obvious.
Perfect. Yeah, no, that's really useful to know. And you would just go to a local, I was about to say solicitor or lawyer in the US. They would draw something out for you.
Yeah, there aren't too many forms like this on the internet. And you know, I'm in the business of making these kinds of forms, so these kinds of documents. So I'm always happy to help out. And you know, if you do need a solicitor in your local area, and you need a starting point, you can start with me and then run it by someone local for adaptation.
Indeed. Well, good segue through to the end, Gordon. So just to let you know, if you're out there listening, Gordon does a show called Entertainment Law Update, which is a monthly show about his industry, about everything around the entertainment law area. I'm sure it's a good listen. I'm going to go and have a wee listen after this. I think there's tons in there I can pick up, I'm sure, related to what we're doing. So go along and have a listen to there, certainly as soon as you can. But also, yeah, if you have any questions about contracts you want to look at getting something drawn up, then I'm sure Gordon's your man. Where would people get in touch with you, Gordon?
Well, you can always find me on firemark.com. That's the best and easiest way to do it. I'll also tell you, I have an ebook called The Podcast Blog and New Media Producers Legal Survival Guide.
Oh.
It's available at, so that's really, you know, the starting point. Rather than hiring a lawyer, you may want to just pick my book.
Yes.
And that is at podcastlawbook.com.
Perfect. And that'll give everyone a good idea of where to begin with all of this, all the questions they should be asking. I think that's the trouble. Sometimes we just don't know. We don't know what we don't know in this case. So a book like that sounds like a great start. So is that available? Is that available on Amazon elsewhere?
Well, it's an ebook, so it's a download, and it's available at podcastlawbook.com. You can actually
get it there. Perfect.
From Amazon, or maybe it's lulu.com.
Excellent. Okay, that's perfect. Well, thanks very much for your time, Gordon. It's been really useful. It's answered a whole bunch of questions that I've had for the last little while. So again, thanks for joining us. And I hope you have continued success with your own show.
Well, thank you. It's been a genuine pleasure.
Great. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.